Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and if you are going to appeal to heaven, you can do it publicly, you can do it privately. If you want to make your own public group, let us know, but we've got Loudon Liberty on our webpage, on the Red State Talk Radio podcast page, where you can actually get the link and join the Zoom call based on the time that's there. So anyway, we've got Tammy with us, and your campaign begins today. Let me just start off with this, and let me see if this segues into something else, but the longer we sit on our hands, the longer we remain silent, or when we allow ourselves to be silenced and we abide by that silence, the more problems are going to occur. When we have direct dialogue, there is always the opportunity to actually, I'll just say, work the problems through. If we're not having a direct dialogue, if we're not at least having, as they use the terms, intercourse, if we the people are not actively having intercourse on what we need to do regarding this government, then we cannot expect anything to change, and we can only expect things to get worse. So it's been a couple of days since the inauguration, and as I see it, I've talked to a lot of people that have either attended. I know people that actually attended the inauguration, and I know people that, you know, didn't. They went there to attend, but they didn't, and because they couldn't. They weren't allowed. And then I knew that there were people that actually went to the different inauguration parties around town. Now, I think each of the different parties might have a different, you know, feel to it, a different type of, you know, environmental feel. You know what I mean, Tammy?
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that, and this is what I've heard. I have heard that the sentiments coming from people, because what Trump did after he was inaugurated, I don't know, do you know how many executive orders he signed already?
I don't. I heard about one of them that I completely disagree, though. Like,
okay, which one? Go ahead.
The one where he says that even if you're born here, you know, if your parents are not citizens, but you're born here, then he's...
Oh, he's accepting or embracing the anchor baby policy.
He's taking that away.
In other words, he's sending people back even if you're born here. Oh, well, that is the law, because it is antithetical to the nucleus of government is the people, and the nucleus of, you know, that's our society, right? The nucleus of society, government, the people is the family.
Wouldn't they have to change the 14th Amendment?
No, so the 14th Amendment, and that, you know, I'm glad you brought it up, because we can actually read the Constitution as it was dictated, and we can go through that. So let me pull it up. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The kicker is, and subjects to the jurisdiction thereof. When a child is born, they attach to the subject, or I should say the nationality and or the country of origin of their parents. Now, if one of those parents is a U.S. citizen and another one is a different citizenship, then that child would be born with dual citizenship and they would not be a natural born citizen, but they would at least have the citizenship of that one parent. Does that make sense? So in Obama's case, Obama was born to an American citizen and a Kenyan.
Mm-hmm.
Whether he was born in the United States or in Kenya, it really doesn't matter, because to be a natural born citizen, both parents have to be citizens. You can't have a split citizenship. So, because that's exactly what it says. Any person born to U.S. citizens, plural, you know, and that there's only one way that can be, with a man and a woman, a husband, wife, mother, father. I mean, so both parents have to be citizens. Have to be. So that's a natural born citizen. A person born here, they have to have at least one citizen under the jurisdiction of the United States. If they're born to two people that have not naturalized, therefore they're not a citizen to the United States, they're only a guest in the United States and under the jurisdiction of Honduras, Mexico, Russia, it doesn't matter, China. It doesn't matter where they're from. They could be just on the other side of that border in Mexico, and they cannot be citizens. The Supreme Court has redefined what this line means. The intent behind this line was all of the slaves and even the Indians who have lived for generations, because the United States had been around, because this is 1866, had been around for a few generations now. And so because we actually stopped the slave trade as well. So the presumption is that we don't have any new people imported here. Every person that has been born here has been born here under the auspices of slavery or under the auspices of living on a reservation and being under the control of the federal government, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're on a reservation, what jurisdiction do you fall under? You may have a tribal jurisdiction, but you also fall under the federal jurisdiction. Now, that was all unconstitutional. You actually should have fell under the state jurisdiction, but then that you still would have become a citizen. Because the whole point here was, if you were under the jurisdiction, if you were a slave or an Indian, because you were living here under the jurisdiction, but you weren't a citizen at that point. And the reason this was added was because of the Dred Scott trial and the ruling, I think it was by Taney, Chief Justice Taney, who said that slaves cannot be citizens, blacks cannot be citizens. That flew in the face of blacks already being citizens, who had already been voting since many of them all of a sudden lost the right to vote in the early 1800s when the state started oppressing the freemen. And so it became a kind of institutionalized racism that the government started taking on, and it really started rearing its head or becoming far more, I'll just say, tyrannical as of the 1820s when the federal government started inflicting slavery. This is when the federal government really abandoned, you know, state sovereignty and the state concept. And this is when the states and the slaveholders wanted the federal government to start inflicting and actually dictating and taking away state sovereignty. So, looking at this concept of a child becoming a U.S. citizen when both parents are Mexican or both parents are Russian or what have you, and those people have to get kicked out, then the concept of making that child a citizen and not being able to go as citizen as this, you know, as the citizenship of their parents, because when a child is naturalized, when two parents come here and they have children already, and when if they're those children are, I think, 12 and younger or 16 and younger, whatever that age is, those children naturalize with their parents. We would not want to create a condition where we would break up the family.
Yeah, true.
Okay, so the concept is honoring that family and that family allegiance. That's the whole reason why a person has to be naturalized. And actually, I'm not sure what the states did, but I do believe that the states probably had I'll call it, you know, a naturalization, becoming a, you know, a process of becoming a state citizen, where they actually had an oath to become a U.S. citizen that you had to honor and support, or actually support and defend the U.S. Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. So, I mean, everybody's familiar with that citizen oath. And until, if you've not been born here, because when you're born here, you're, that oath is implied. It's a birthright, but it is also an obligation, because we're all obligated to take up arms to support and defend the Constitution. Where if you weren't born here and you didn't take that oath, we couldn't obligate you to do that. If all of a sudden things started going south in America because of insurrections or what have you, we would have to start deporting people, because we wouldn't want foreigners to be involved in our domestic affairs like that, to take sides. Okay, so these things, you know, when you really, it takes some time to logically work through, but the key point of this, all persons born or naturalized in the United States, so they're born, even if they're not naturalized, but they're born and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens. And so how were slaves and how were Indians, and I've said this before, slaves were apportioned. In other words, they were allocated for apportionment for representation, which means that they had representation, which means that they were under the jurisdiction of the United States, because that was right there in the Constitution. Now, with Indians, they actually got dragged into this, whether they like it or not. And as a matter of fact, we've been at fault here. We need to fix this. Indians need to be freed. They need to be given that land that doesn't belong to the federal government. The federal government kind of reserved that for them. So that should be their land. Now, how that happens, I think the state needs to take stewardship and say, you know what? We don't want power brokers to actually, you know, excuse the expression, screw over other people in the tribe. Because we know that that's always happens. That the best way to do that would probably be parsing up all of the land, you know, and allowing the tribe to dictate, what do you want to do with this common land? Do you want that to be hunting? Do you want that to be, you know, agrarian? Do you want that to be community or what have you? Because if so, then you need to form, you know, a business or whatever you want to call that, so that anything you yield or what have you. But see, the state has the responsibility of, as you know, taking track of, because some states actually have property tax. And so if they have property tax in that state, then they would have to eventually start taxing the Indians for their property that they own. And so, but here's the problem that I have with property tax. Having property tax and making it compulsory to where they can take your land is antithetical to government.
Yes.
So property tax needs to be shifted to a more voluntary thing. I think it's okay if you want to pay property tax so that you can assist in paying for the education, for, you know, these little things that the government doesn't have the ability, and the church isn't going to do it anymore. But we've already had this conversation. Why do we need to have, you know, so many teachers? I don't think we need to have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of teachers in America. I believe that we can have the best and brightest because technology allows us to do that. If you've gone, and I know you went to yaymath.org, right? What do you think of that?
I think it was great.
And so what, does he not do a good job? He does a great job, and this has already been captured. I mean, when it comes to math, teaching somebody how to do that formula, you only need to learn it once, right? Help me out here. Okay, so once he's gone through, and, you know, sometimes he even explains it and what have you, but do you really need to have five teachers teach you the same formula? I don't think so, but maybe you need a tutor to help you. Maybe that would help, but bottom line, most people get it when they're sitting in the classroom. Those few people that don't, they need a tutor. My point is that this guy's the best, and I think he does a great job in helping all the kids understand, because he actually has great examples of kids asking questions and so on. What is this? And he makes it interesting. My point is this. why not just pay for his classes and teach all kids math by the one really good teacher that reaches out to kids and find somebody else that does something the same way? Because this is how we actually inject the knowledge into a child without the personal baggage that a teacher always drags into the room. As they start complaining about government because they have the latitude every hour, 5 days a week, they got to make the time up, so they complain about whatever they want to, and they drive personal agendas, weaponizing our children to basically reject the Constitution, reject their liberty. You know, we want to get rid of guns and these types of things. This should never have been happening in our school system. Should never have happened. And the progressives knew that that's where they needed to go to actually start basically, I'll just say, incrementally moving society into embracing communism. And that's what they did since the very beginning. So now we can undo all of that. Now we can actually protect ourselves from that type of thing. And it's one thing for a child to sit in a classroom where they're learning about civics and different forms of government and so forth than the child. And this is how the parents can actually, if you want to call it audit or you want to call it a review or what have you, the parents can actually hear. And again, because the teacher's not in that room, your children are far more safer from their baggage. Does that not make
true
sense?
True that.
Okay. So anyway.
What's all the confusion of Common Core math?
Okay. So you're not the only person that I've met that understood the bank, or I'll call it the anchor baby, not the banker baby, the anchor baby as a legitimate process, because the courts basically wanted to extend the right of a citizen to anybody and everybody. Why? Because if everybody had a right of a citizen, then, and the whole world, if they could just get here, then they would have their day in court. What does that mean to the court system? If everybody could have their day in court, that would keep these guys busy, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would be a lot of money for the courts.
It's like an awful lot of chaos to me.
Absolutely. So they, because technically they believe that these things are within their bailiwick of regarding the rights of citizens and the 14th Amendment and so forth. The reality is the 14th Amendment, and when states start violating, because again, it's the next part of Section 1 where the 14th Amendment, where states seem to have the federal government is the bane of their existence, because the federal government comes in and they get involved within the citizens' cases and start ruling and using an iron fist and telling the state that, you know, you've got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do that. When technically the only thing the federal government should do is if the states make a law or enforce a law that abridges the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, the only thing that the federal court should do is that law violates the citizens' rights. If they shouldn't get involved in the individual case itself. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. There you go. So, interestingly enough, was there anything else that you got out of the executive orders? I mean, the ending of the DEI and all of that, that's good, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
You can do that, right?
Because yeah.
That was never an enumerated power anyway. So.
That's right. There was never an enumeration for the federal government to be involved in cultures, to be involved in, you know, the only thing that they have is you cannot be denied your right to vote because of race. That's it.
Right.
Or because of gender or sex, right? You can't be denied your right to vote because of age. But this concept of, well, we have to make sure that you have equal, I'll use equal representation, but there's another term for it where when they look at a community, because this is what the federal government's labor laws were doing, they'd look at a community, and I worked in an engineering field. And there's not a lot of people with degrees that have engineering degrees. And so they basically said, okay, in your demographics, you have a lot of Hispanics, you have a lot of women, and you don't have enough of them. And so you need to hire more Hispanics and more women. Or if we were living maybe in a more predominant black, they would say you need to have more blacks. Well, what do you do if there's just those numbers don't even exist? Then you have to constantly fight the federal government. This is all unconstitutional, first off. But secondly, you constantly have to fight the Department of Labor, you know, why you can't hire people because they have to have a degree. Right. Yeah. And so they, what they do is they go on the other end and they try to, you know, they do everything they can to get people in through the pipeline to just finish off their degree. Now, the interesting thing and the nice thing about medicine and the nice thing about engineering is technically to become an engineer, it's not by a degree. You actually have to pass a test. You got to be certified to be an engineer. And that's not an easy test. Believe me. So my father, his major was in political science. And he actually went, because he was an engineer as well. He did drawings and so forth. But he went and actually took the test and passed the engineering test to be a certified engineer, which that was huge because, I mean, most engineers can't even pass that test, you know, because they're only trained in just one little facet like computer science or they're in, you know, something else, but they don't have the full gamut of an engineering certificate. And so even where I worked, you know, there were very few people that were certified, and most of those guys said, why? I don't need that to have a job. And that was the truth. You didn't need the certificate because it was too high of a bar. It's unlike doctors. Now, in medicine, doctors actually have to be passed the board to become a doctor, right? And so as they all have to do that to practice medicine, that, you know, it's a little bit tougher. So getting people into the pipeline to do some of these certain fields is one thing. Yeah, they may be able to get C's throughout and so forth, but whether they pass that bar exam or whether they pass that certification is something different. And so anyway, all these types of regulations do is try to create contention and division, where the government is, they should have no dog in that fight. Anyway, I digress.
So let's go back to the executive orders. Is there anything that he's done that he should not have done with executive orders? Do you know? I mean, you may not have had a chance to.
So every single one of them, when he was dictating that these policies, these laws that were inserted by either Biden or Congress, right? Congress passed acts or what have you, that he may be undoing. And as a matter of fact, the Supreme Court had basically made an edict that an anchor baby is a legitimate thing. And so I'm telling you right now, he's going down this path of, and who knows, the Supreme Court may buckle, but he's going down this path of basically poking the Supreme Court and Congress and, you know, everybody in the federal government kind of, if you think you got an agenda, you're going to have to take it up with me. And so he should never have done that. What he should have done was he should have basically told, this is what I said on my show, he should completely revamp the Department of Justice and basically start enforcing the Constitution, that any laws or anything that violates that and anybody that's pushing those types of things, we're going to go into a break real quick. So we'll pick this up on the other side of the break. But the bottom line is he should have actually, you see, he does have the responsibility of enforcing the Constitution and constitutional laws. He has no responsibility of enforcing anything that is unconstitutional. And so, like I said, we need to pick this up on the other side of the break. So I'll stop myself right there, and I'll be good so that I won't babble into the break. We'll be right back, folks. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me kind of explain what I've kind of been saying on the Monday and Friday shows, talking about what a constitutional President Trump could really do. And so, because I know some people were taking it, and I actually was calling it a criticism, but I think we just need to tone it to, you know, he has this opportunity to do these things. He doesn't have to do what everybody else has done. Just because everybody did the wrong thing doesn't mean he's obligated to do the wrong thing. Passing executive orders to actually change very specific laws is unconstitutional, but because he's basically making a law. But he does have the authority to basically make a complete change of the Department of Justice and retool them to becoming the Department of Compliance to the Constitution, because that is what they need to be doing. They need to be making sure that the laws that are being passed are constitutional. He does not have an obligation to lift a finger or spend any money whatsoever on things that aren't constitutional. He can't dismantle all these unconstitutional departments, but as they start creating laws and so forth, they can start getting rid of Congress. They can start getting rid of judges. They can start getting rid of bureaucrats and so forth who are pushing these things, and he can basically defund these things because he doesn't have to spend a penny on something that's not constitutional. Health and Human Services, labor, housing, on and on and on. But what he needs to do, the one thing he needs to do, is he needs to be in every state flapping his gums to say, this is your constitution, not mine. I'm only here to execute the laws. You need to demand the federal government to get into compliance and disband and basically dismantle all of these unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, powers, and so forth and so on, so that, you know, we actually get back to functioning underneath the Constitution. Now, what I believe is happening is this is the moral side of the coin of tyranny, which is basically the exact opposite side of what we've been dealing with Biden. Let me ask you this. Would you like to see Biden and Obama impeached? Now, you may have, just by chance, you may have yourself on mute still. And so, I don't know. Maybe we lost Tammy. Maybe she...
There we are. Okay. I was on mute.
All right. So, what do you think? Do you think it would be good for the United States to actually impeach Clinton, the Bush, the living Bush president, Obama, and Biden? Remember, he was impeached, and technically and legally, he could have been impeached. The charges they brought up on him really
talking
fell
about
short.
Clinton? Which one are you talking about?
Yes, so we're talking. Carter's dead, Reagan's dead, right? And HW's dead. I mean, we don't have any other presidents other than Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Biden. Those are the four living presidents that can be impeached, because they set precedents, and actually they were correct in going after a former president to impeach them, because impeachment is not a criminal trial. Impeachment is the act of removing the emoluments and position of the individual. A former president in the Constitution is a citizen. There's nothing called the former president. There's no tax money spent on any foreign federal government person. I should say senator, representative, judge, or what have you. There was no retirement for these folks. No permanent emoluments like the former president going around the world and speaking and making millions of dollars. So technically, all of these guys can be impeached. They could be basically slammed down to citizens. They could lose their Secret Service, you know, I'll say entourage, and they could basically literally be held here where they can't even travel abroad, because clearly the only person that has foreign influence from the United States is the president. And this is why I said earlier, and I took some flack on this, and I know that I brush over things, and so sometimes people just get really inflamed, and, you know, sometimes we let, you know, how we feel or emotions or what have you drive us. But the reality is the president has the responsibility of enforcing the law, and he has the responsibility of setting the tone for international relations. The president can actually, in public comments, and if he travels abroad, if he goes to Japan, he could literally be yelling over the whatever that little, you know, strait or what have you between Japan and China, and telling the people in Hong Kong, hey, you guys have been protesting, You've been having elections. If you want to have an election, and this should be to the whole world, this is just not coming from the U.S., the free world should basically be telling the people of Hong Kong, have an election. We will, as an international body, come in and, you know, help you conduct a free and open election to determine if you want to actually continue being, you know, gulped up into the Chinese Communist Party's arms, or whether you want to become a free state and have your own governance. You have the right to basically dictate, because this becomes I would just say, an inalienable right. We recognize this, and I think the world recognizes this. And I would basically, because if the president does this and the rest of the world doesn't want to get on board, then the whole world will see that. In other words, the leadership of the world that wants to go and maintain this globalist UN, then this actually should wake up the entire world to say, if we can't be free, if we can't have liberty, because you won't help preserve it in these other countries, that means that we're all in danger.
Yeah.
Right. The reality is the world... the globalization of communism is around the corner, and there's an opportunity to wake the world up. My problem is, and this is what I believe, I just don't believe Trump wants to wake the world up.
No, I don't think so.
Right. Okay.
I don't think so.
All right. So
I think he's got the right idea. I just don't think it's the complete right idea.
Well, I honestly see, because I don't know if you saw the inauguration with Barron waving and all of that. Boy, he's being prepared. And, you know, I think some of his other sons are being prepared to basically inject themselves into politics post-Trump. Mm-hmm. And in other words, we're now going to have another family of royalty like the Clintons and the Obamas and the Bushes.
Yeah.
And
if I were president, I would hire, you know, immediately a constitutional scholar or an expert on the Constitution. That's what I would do.
Yeah. And so they get these guys from Hillsdale College because they have a piece of paper that says they have this education on the Constitution and so forth. But They really don't. They don't understand because nobody has based their level of education on the Constitution on the ratification debates, which is one of the reasons why we're going through these readings. And so that way, as you know, you've only seen a few, but we're going to go through many more of points when Madison basically points to the ratification debates is the only way to understand the Constitution, right? You read the letter from John G. or letter to John G. Jackson, and he told them outright. It didn't matter what we thought at the convention that what the Constitution meant. The only thing that matters is what the states understood it at the time of ratification. So why are we even dabbling? There was never a time, not once, did he ever utter the lips, read the Federalist Papers. And isn't it interesting that John Marshall became the advocate for the Federalist Papers and he didn't even write them? And I'm not even sure he even really read them other than the fact that Alexander Hamilton gave them to him and pointed to the, I'm going to presume, he knew, Hamilton knew what he was doing. I have no documentation, evidence of this, but he knew what he did. He knew he injected those last Federalist Papers on the judiciary. He injected those for a very specific purpose, to help the judiciary grandize their role beyond the boundaries of the Constitution so that they could actually start creating law. And so what ended up happening was Marshall...
So he on purpose put in the Federalist Papers for that reason?
Yes. He injected... We went through this last summer. And you may want to actually,
it's been a while.
You may want to actually listen to that podcast that you were there, because we were reading some of the letters that Hamilton was writing that literally was going to Madison saying, you need to let me know as soon as Virginia is going to ratify, if they're going to ratify, if you've got any predilection, let me know. And apparently he got the indication that New Hampshire was going to actually ratify. He got that news a couple of days ahead of time, because he actually released the very first Federalist paper the same day New Hampshire formally ratified the Constitution. Now, you can't tell me that he wrote that the same day, but you can tell me that he wrote that in advance because he had advanced warning. And that's when he started injecting. And all of these other Federalist papers that were written for a couple of weeks into July, the Constitution had already been ratified. What was the point of doing that other than to create, and it was all over the judiciary. All of those Federalist Papers he injected at the end of the Federalist Papers were over the judiciary. Folks, you have institutions called the education system that is priming lawyers and judges based on these lies that Hamilton spun in these Federalist Papers. This is where they've been able to, they feel that they have the authority to create law and to redefine the law by interpreting. The language of interpretation only came from the Federalist Papers. I think it was 80-something, 81 or something like that. And so if you go look at that, you go, oh my gosh, that's where there. You will not find the concept of judiciaries interpreting the law. As a matter of fact, the Constitution dictates that they will judge based on law and fact, no interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so,
and I know this is new. Like, that concept is new.
Well, so that conflict and that concept actually came from Marshall in 1800 when he was appointed, because Hamilton convinced Adams to appoint these judges, and one of the judges was Marshall. And so Marshall actually had a plan. And this is when Hamilton was still alive, and they literally started executing this plan. And Madison and Jefferson had their hands tied with Britain and world intrigue and affairs with the, you know, trying to deal with this nation. And when they were looking at Marshall over in his rulings, babbling and so forth, you know, they never gave it any serious consideration. Why didn't they ever talk about the opinions coming from Marshall, where he was making outlandish assertions that the federal government could do anything they thought necessary and proper? Why didn't Hamilton or Madison say something about that? Because an opinion has no legal standing. Mm-hmm. Even if he's wrong or right, it doesn't matter. It has no precedence. It has no position. It has no allowance in directing the change of law. It's just an opinion. It's like an editorial in a paper. And then down the road, all of these opinions were grabbed up when they started using case law and pointed to what Hamilton said, as if he was the definitive judge on what was true and what wasn't true. This is how it all began. And so they started assuming, and they started using this interpretation. And anyway, it just got crazy. But bottom line, Hamilton was the forefront in the attack against the Constitution. So, anywho.
He was a plant.
Yes, well, I wish I had more concrete evidence, but I don't. So, where we left off with the Confederation, the Articles of Confederation, was Article 5. And we basically did the second paragraph, so I'll reread that, and I can let you pick it up from there. No state shall be represented in Congress by less than 2 nor more than 7 members, and no person shall be capable of being a delegate for more than 3 years in any term of 6 years, nor shall any person being a delegate of being capable of holding any office under the United States for which he or another for his benefit receives any salary, fees, or emoluments of any other kind. In other words, if they hold a position at the state, the county, or anything else. You can't be the sheriff and still be paid as the sheriff while you're working in Continental Congress. And you were tied to only 3 years out of 6. So in other words, you couldn't be forced to do, you know, constant delegation, nor could you, you know, be completely limited, because after 6 years, you could come back for 3 more years, because it was term limits of 3 years out of 6. But that was the beginning concept of term limits. And when they talked about term limits, when they were talking about the U.S. Constitution, because some states wanted to have something like that, like in the Articles of Confederation, and Madison said, why do you need it to be in the law when the voters have the, you know, clearly the, if they want that person to be their representative, they should be able to decide that. Who are we to say they can't have the people they want?
Yeah.
Other than the fact that if they violate their oath, then they can't represent anymore. But they didn't have that law. That wasn't in the Constitution. So go ahead and pick it up from, you know, each state shall maintain.
Okay. Well, let me go back and find it.
Okay.
Each state shall maintain its own delegates in a meeting of the states, and while they act as members of the committee of the states.
Uh-huh. Keep going.
Okay. In determining questions in the United States in Congress assembled, each state shall have 1 vote.
Okay. What does that mean?
Congress assembled.
Okay.
Well, each state shall have a vote.
Okay, so let's look at our current configuration, because in the Articles of Confederation, each state could have no more, a minimum of 2, but no more than what, 5? What was it? No more than 7 members. So they had to have a minimum of 2, no less than 2. Each state needed to have representation of 2 members, 2 delegates from their state. And they had, you know, they had to have 7. What ended up happening was some of the states, they were so poor, they couldn't pay for the delegations of the minimum of their 2. So they would ask, give proxy to, would you give us the representation for 2 of our delegates so that we would have the requisite participation? Right? So in other words, those 2 people were actually, from one state fulfilling the obligations of another state's attendants and would be voting for them. So that's how they were doing it, because they just couldn't afford to do it because they were so broke. And they didn't see the need because they were capable of doing whatever they wanted to do anyway. Why did, you know, the Articles and Continental Congress, the Articles of Confederation and Continental Congress was literally lipstick on a pig.
I love that term.
It goes all the way back to, you know, the Obama run against McCain. And so when we look at the power the Continental Congress had, I mean, there's other terms like, you know, teats on a boar, what have you. So right. there's all sorts of metaphors for basically they're useless. Continental Congress was useless. And what amazes me is there's so many people out there, you know, putting their arms, wrapping themselves up into their own little hug, saying, oh, how great it would be if we had the Articles of Confederation again. Because it was an abject failure, a total failure. So anyway, go ahead, the freedom of speech and debate.
Freedom of speech and debate in Congress shall not be impeached or questioned in any court or place out of Congress, and the members of Congress shall be protected in their persons from arrests or imprisonments during the time of their going to and from an attendance on Congress, except for treason, felony, or breach of the peace.
Okay, so basically there's your clause that gave them above the law kind of privileges, that they could say what they wanted and they could come and go as they please, you know, in a ruckus. In other words, you could speed on your way, what have you. It didn't matter because they were above the law. They couldn't be held or what have you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Unless it was for treason, felony, or breach. In other words, they had to behave really badly. Okay. All right. So, 6.
No state without the consent of the United States in Congress assembled shall send any embassy to or receive any embassy from or enter into any conference, agreement, alliance, or treaty with any king, prince, or state, nor shall any person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States or any of them accept any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. Nor shall the United States in Congress assembled or any of them grant any title of nobility.
Okay. Go ahead and read. Well, actually, we can stop there. And so what is that basically saying? That no state could create an embassy or have direct foreign relations without Congress's consent.
Right.
And yet every state was already conferring their own trade agreements with multiple states in Europe, in basically bypassing Continental Congress. And Congress had no ability to tax the imports or anything. They had really no ability to do any taxation, direct taxation, or any form of taxation upon the states and enforce it. So if you created this almighty fascia, you know, this general government is going to represent us in these things. And basically, you're back behind them doing everything, working around them and so forth. I mean, it's almost like deciding to protect yourself, you know, wrapped in paper from, you know, going into a bullet fight instead of putting on Kevlar and, you know, real protection. You know, they didn't empower Congress to actually protect them.
Right.
Okay. So no two or more.
No two or more states shall enter into any treaty, confederation, or alliance, whatever between them, without the consent of the United States in Congress assembled, specifying accurately the purposes for which the same is to be entered into and how long it shall continue.
Okay. That's kind of what I just said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is just conferring more and more that the states were forbidden to be able to do these things in the Articles of Confederation. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard me say this before, but prior to the Constitutional Convention, it became pretty apparent, and actually, prior to the Revolution, many of the states decided to do their own things. And because they were sovereign, they had this liberty and this ability to do that. However, because they were subjects of the king kind of held them to a standard. And they had he had a pretty heavy hand. So much so that he started really reeling them in and then said, you know what? They're going to pay for what we want to do, and they're not going to like it, but we're going to do this. And they were committed to inflicting this upon us to a point where we actually rebelled. So the states kind of inflicted this pain upon themselves, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were already exceeding, when a child starts feeling like a son can test dad, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen every time, but every once in a while you get a son that may actually go toe-to-toe with dad.
Sure.
And 9 times out of 10, that time comes a little early for the son to be able to say, yeah, And 9 times out of 10, it only happens for the son when the son finally gets to the strength and wisdom, knowledge, the experience necessary to really beat dad. Well, by that point in time, they've already changed their hearts and minds, and they're no longer rebelling against dad, and they've recognized how much dad knows that, they don't have that drive anymore. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, because I've seen.
You've been there?
What's that? Yeah, I've been there, and when you're picking your son up off of his back because you put him on the ground, and it's helping him up, and you see that in his eyes. He goes, "Wow, I didn't think you could do that." But it wasn't like it was in anger or guile. It was just, we were kind of wrestling around, and then he thought he could put a move, and boom. I'm not going to do, I'm not going down that way. You're going to go down. So anyway, my point is that there's times when it happens when the son is really rebelling, and there have been cases where the son would actually get, because the father would be abusive to mom or somebody else in the family, and the son big enough and old enough, and dad would be drunk, and he would basically, hit him with the fist and say, "Get out of here. You're not doing this anymore." And then that's when dad has to eat some crow and realize he was really in the wrong. There are reasons and purposes for, the stand-up and rebellion. But the point is that, if the parent is doing right or what have you, if you can't catch them off guard, you're probably going to have your comeuppance. And I think the colonies were getting their comeuppance. As a matter
of fact,
and guess what colony seemed to be getting the dole of the serious comeuppance? What was the colony that was hit first in the Revolution? Or I should say the colony that was hit first with hard tyranny. That was Massachusetts. And right. Massachusetts. So tomorrow, folks, what I'm going to do is I'll give you a little bit of statistics regarding Massachusetts at the time of the Revolution and how they actually had a big chip on their shoulder. And we kind of identify this in the ratification debates because they had something to have a chip about. I mean, they had a legitimate reason. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.